Attention all Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn radio listeners. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes. John certainly needs a friend like you to help make his dreams come true, minus the alien abduction dreams. That is not cool at all. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Always available. Always free. Always odd.
The following podcast is brought to you by Newfie EVP, Talking with the Dead in Newfoundland. Jump on Amazon.ca today and get your free sample of the best-selling ebook in Unexplained Mysteries.
It's the odd to Newfoundland. Ghostly greetings from your host, Jonathan. Mysteries, ghosts, monsters, and lore. East Coast esoterica and so much more. If it's up to you, friend, it's on the up to Newfoundland.
Ghostly greetings from the oldest city in North America. I'm your host, John Mallard, bringing you the best in East Coast esoterica. You, my friends, have stumbled upon the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast for the month of July 2018. Happy Canada Day, happy Independence Day, guys. And if no one's told you on this wonderful, wonderful long weekend, let me be the first to tell you that you're wonderful. You're a masterpiece, beautifully made, important to people because you're important to me. You're highly favored by your creator, whether that is the law of physics and averages working in tandem, or, what I believe in, a god. You're thirsty for knowledge and addicted to wonder. You, my friend, are an oddball, and here on this show, you're family, and we are one. This is episode 56 of the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, your monthly paranormal variety show. Whew, that's a mouthful, hey? It never gets any easier. It never gets any easier. A lot of people are always like, you know, John, seriously, man, you've been doing this bumper now for 4 years. 4 years. It's the same bumper every single show. And, you know, you can just make life so much easier on yourself. All you got to do is record it. Just record it and then copy and paste it. And you have to, but you know what? I feel like it takes away from the freshness of the show. So there you go. Here's a little Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast fact just for you guys. Maybe to celebrate our four-year anniversary, which is going on today, by the way. For the last 4 years, I have done an original bumper for every single Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. That is my voice at different times in my life. I sound different every single time I do this podcast because I record it live. And when I record it live, what I mean by that is I don't do a whole lot of bumpers during the show. The music's the same, and I try to mix the same stuff, but everything is pretty raw. And I also have an old-fashioned mic setup. I got my mic to the right of me. Sometimes you can hear me breathing a little bit, but that's the natural sound that's in the room. It's actually a podcasting closet. And when I do my podcast, I close the door behind me and sit down. So there you go. I'm giving you guys a little behind-the-scenes look at the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. One thing I love about podcasting is it's just me time. It's time to get away from, as much as I love them, it's time to get away from my family and hang out with my crazy, strange, I guess I consider you guys in-laws at this point in my life. I mean, it's been 4 years, 4 years of the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. And, you know, I have just had so many crazy things happen to me over the last 4 years since I started doing this show. And you guys have just been there every step of the way. To my longtime listeners, thank you so much for believing in me and what I do. For all the newbies out there who kind of just got on the scene, thanks so very, very much for taking a chance on the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Because this show is 4 years old today. And 4 years from now, when I'm still doing the show, I hope you guys are still subscribed to my channel, and I hope you guys are still really enjoying the quality work I put into this podcast. You know, there's been a lot of people who sent me my best wishes and stuff like that, and I just want to put it out to you guys. I got a lot of messages on Facebook about the upcoming anniversary special. Last year, I did Canadian Odyssey, where I actually did different paranormal stories from all across Canada. It was a gigantic show with no guest, but I kind of felt in my heart that this show had to be extra special. And, you know, I did the whole Canada Day one last year. This year, I'm going to stick with, really, my original format. As we celebrate the fourth year of the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast, I'm bringing on a guest later in the show that's been just recommended to me so very many times, which is William Devney. And William is just, he really is an authority on Bigfoot and one of the best guests I can get on the topic. Because as you guys know, I mean, when I think of a quality guest, I'm going to bring on somebody who's been, like, just for the four-year anniversary, somebody who's published multiple books on the topic. He's been around for, it seems like, forever. I've heard him talk many times. He's had his own shows. He's been a part of shows that were I was listening to really like 6-7 years ago myself when I first started getting interested in podcasting. And, you know, to have him on, I think, is just an amazing guest. So I hope you guys really, really enjoy that as my gift to you. You know, a little bit of a paranormal celebrity, so to speak, and Will. And just my little thank you to you guys for always being there. We are getting dangerously close to 1,000 subscribers on Podbean right now. So if you're listening to this show and you're not subscribed yet, I mean, gosh, you gotta subscribe. This is a free show. I like to keep it that way. And having 1,000 subscribers is really one of the first of many steps that I want to take to getting some new sponsors for the show. As, you know, as the economy kind of suffered a little bit here in Newfoundland over the last year or two, I kind of lost a couple of my other sponsors because they literally went out of business. This happened. Now, it's not because of what they paid me, trust me. I literally do this for practically nothing. But, you know, just throwing out there to you guys, a great way to support my show is to share it, like it, leave comments. I love comments. And, you know, sometimes I read comments on the air when time permits. And, you know, when I get 4 or 5 or whatever that in a row, I'll kind of leave a few if they're interesting enough anyway. So, you know what? Hit me up. Go on the Podbean app. Subscribe. Leave a message. Let me know how you feel about the show. Maybe some suggestions for guests. Maybe you want to be a guest on the show. And you guys can always get me very easily on the actual website. Just look up Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast and you'll find an actual contact down at the bottom right-hand side of the webpage. Also, you can always just get me at John C. Mallard, J-O-N C. Mallard, M-A-L-L-A-R-D at hotmail.com. That's my professional email, of course, if you guys want to be a guest or have a suggestion for me. Before I move on, I also have news for you guys. As you guys know, in my, I like to say, real world, use my quotation marks. I know you can't see me doing that with my little bunny ears right now because it's a podcast. as you guys know, I had a foster child go home back in, really it was February leading into March. And, you know, there's no doubt that there's been a hole in my heart since he left. And, you know, I'm going to throw this out to you right now. I didn't know if I was going to be able to get this show out to you guys because, well, when it rains, it pours and boom, new placement. And I've got a new child in my care right now. It's a short-term one. So, you know, to me, obviously, it's a relief for me and my family because this is what we want to do. And, but anyway, I just wanted to mention that because it's just something really positive. I get to help another soul and it's what I love to do. And one thing you'll notice over the years of listening to this show is I think I've grown up a lot in the last 4 years. I really feel like I have. And, you know, not just with quality show, because I listened to an earlier show the other day just for a laugh. And man, oh, man, it was terrible. But podcasters always say that about their work. My last thing I want to throw out to you guys is just a heartfelt thank you for all your support over the years. I'm not stopping this. I don't want to stop this. And at the end of the day, when I say you're a friend of mine and, you know, you're an oddball, just like me and, you know, here on this show, we are family and we are one. I truly do mean that. So believe it at that. And we'll get moving on to July's paranormal news. Well, guys, can you remember last show when I was kind of talking about, well, really, they were doing this thing with Loch Ness, okay? They were doing these DNA tests to aid the hunt for Nessie and all this stuff. And this isn't really a follow-up, but apparently since they've done that on the Loch, there has been a few more sightings and one caught on video camera. I'm going to talk about that one right now. A man from Donegal captured the video from a webcam that overlooks the famous Scottish Loch. The hospital clerical worker, who often checks the webcam feed to see if he can spot anything, was shocked when he noticed an unusual object moving through the water on April 30th. "I couldn't believe my eyes," he said. "I just started recording it on my phone. I just followed it. It was very unusual. It was certainly something big. It dived up and dived down again and dived and disappeared. It was not a boat, not a log. I would say it was the real deal. It was Nessie. I believe in Nessie, but not as a plesiosaur like many do, but as something that has evolved in Loch Ness over thousands of years." Gary Campbell, keeper of the official register of sightings at Loch Ness, was particularly impressed by the sheer length of the footage, given that most Nessie videos last for only a few blurry seconds. "As far as Nessie footage goes, this is a feature film," he said. "Normally you only get a few videos. They're kind of short. And also, normally, you only get videos of 1 or 2 seconds. It is remarkable in its length, and again shows the increased sightings of Nessie from the internet. Clearly, it is something that dives in and out of the surface with the water, splashing, and reflections. It is unexplained, no doubt. The object would be no larger than 20 feet. There's something there in that video that is clearly moving, and of course, you guys can check out the footage yourself on YouTube. Just look up Loch Ness Monster Sighted Swimming Towards Urquhart Bay. Really, really interesting. I actually looked at the footage myself, and, you know, keeping in with the classic Nessie, Nessie way of doing things, it's a little blurry at first, but it does clear up, so you guys should take a peek at that. It's really weird, and we'll leave it at that. Oh, if I can only see into the future, I'll be able to tell you all what the winning lottery numbers are. But, you know, there's one man who claims to be a time traveler, and he's claiming to be from the year 6491. And, well, this is a real weird one. A man who claims to be from the future is subjected to a lie detector test in a rather dubious new video. The man, who identifies himself as James Oliver and maintains that he's from thousands of years in the future, has appeared in a video on an extremely controversial Apex TV YouTube channel. With his face blanked out and his voice distorted, Oliver can be seen slouched in a chair with his hands hooked up to a computer while another man asks him a series of questions. Inevitably, the supposed lie detector detection equipment returns true for every single one of those questions. Given that Apex TV has previously published several videos featuring alleged time travelers, it is doubtful that extreme that any of them, Oliver included, are actually from the future. Suffice to say, it's best to take this one with a very large pinch of salt. And I thought, just for a bit of fun, I thought I'd play this video for you, see what you guys think. I'm going to play just a few minutes of a few of the first few questions, and just to give you guys a feel for what it is, okay?
From what year again?
6491.
So we're actually set up to do the lie detector test with James. As you can see, we got the lie detector all hooked up, and I think we're all ready to go.
We'll measure the breathing right here. We got skin temperature and sweat right here, and then heart rate.
Correct, yes. Heart rates, sweat, and breathing. All being monitored here. I got the screen recording on the laptop as we're going, as well as the camera right here. And overall, I think we're all set up and ready to go. So let's start off with the basics. The first question is, are you an actual time traveler?
Yes, I am an actual time traveler.
All right, so the lie detector says that you are telling the truth. In the first interview with you, you said you have a time machine. First off, where is it?
Well, I can't tell you that.
So it's actually being hidden somewhere on Earth right now?
Yes, it is being hidden. But I can't tell you that.
Okay, interesting. But you do, in fact, have a time machine?
Yes, I do. It's my spacecraft.
Are you from the year 6491?
Yes. I mean, it would, yes. And I say that because, like I explained in the last video, your years are different than mine. Obviously, your year system started with the death of Jesus Christ, and the death of Jesus Christ, sorry, and mine has dated back to the beginning of the first civilization. Not to mention that where I'm from, the years are longer because my planet is further away from the sun than yours is, so it just takes longer to get around. But we have very, very gifted mathematicians working day and night to come up with algorithms like this to calculate the relationship between our years and the years of the various different planets and civilizations that we research. And so after those calculations are completed, I'm from your equivalent year, 6491.
There you go.
In the future, does everybody have...
I could listen to this all day long. Like, that was really, really interesting. And, every one of these come up, yes. So, I wonder, is this just another farce from this crazy YouTube channel? But, you know what? I'm going to give these guys their props. It's really interesting to listen to. And you guys, of course, can check out Apex TV. Very, very interesting stuff. All right. But, you know, even if you are from the future, you're still going to die, unfortunately. And, well, you know, sometimes you don't actually die. Yeah, it happened again, and it happened in Paraguay. A dead man has interrupted his very own wake in Paraguay. The 20-year-old returned home after 3 days away to find that his family was mourning his death. Juan Ramon Alfonso Pinao of Santa Teresa in Paraguay had been last seen on Thursday when he left his family home on the Brazilian border without telling anyone he was going. The area is particularly dangerous due to disputes between drug gangs, and when Pinao failed to return from his family, grew concerned that something may have happened to him. When police officers later discovered a burned body in the local vicinity, their worst fears seemed to have been realized and arrangements were made to hold a remembrance service. They were all in for the surprise of their lives, however, when Pinao arrived back home right in the middle of his own wake to see his family members mourning over the unknown corpse. The body has since been returned to the local morgue. As for Pinao, his exact whereabouts during the time was missing continue to remain a complete and total mystery. And, you know, like, here in Newfoundland, we have George Street, and I'm sure stuff like this happens all the time where people kind of go downtown, have a lot to drink, and pass out some random's house, and they wake up, and, you know, maybe they get locked in the bathroom, and they're stuck there for a couple days. Like, this stuff happens, but to actually walk in on your own wake, well, I guess it's not the end of the world for his family anymore. I'm happy for them, but I feel kind of bad for him because, well, hopefully they didn't go with the cheaper option and upset him. Oh, man, what are people doing at MIT? Have you heard about this? Skynet is real, people. There's a disturbing experiment that's been designing to highlight the potential dangers of intelligent machines. Named Norman after the main antagonist from the movie Psycho, the new AI was fed on images of people dying to show how easy it is to create a genuinely psychopathic artificial intelligence. Afterwards, the AI was instructed to interpret a series of ink blots so that its answers could be compared to those of another AI that had received more conventional training. The results were surprisingly terrifying. In one example, an ink blot described by a regular AI as a person holding an umbrella in the air was interrupted by Norman as saying, "A man is shot to death in front of his screaming wife." Do you like my Norman Bates robot that time? Yeah, I'm just trying to mimic the guy from Bates Motel. "A man was shot to death in front of his screaming wife." The psychotic artificial intelligence also saw a man murdered by a machine gun in broad daylight, where the regular AI had only seen a regular black-and-white photo of a baseball glove. This is the central idea in machine learning. The data you use to teach a machine learning algorithm can significantly influence its behavior, the MIT researcher stated. So when we talk about AI algorithms being biased or unfair, the culprit is often not the algorithm itself, but the biased data that was fed to it. So there you go. But I mean, I trust humanity. I mean, it's not like we're trying to kill each other constantly or anything. We won't create Skynet, right? You hear about the cafe that closes doors due to paranormal activity? Yeah, this happened this week as well. A cafe in San Antonio, Texas has closed up shop after its owners captured something unusual on camera. The OnLive Hall of Fame Cafe, which opened back in November, had proven quite a hit with the customers thanks to its enticing retro style and focus on old-school food and music. On Thursday, however, its owners took the unexpected decision to close its doors after they were spooked by the seemingly inexplicable occurrence caught on one of the cafe's CCTV cameras. In the video, which you can check out on YouTube, of course, a barricade can be seen suddenly collapsing on its own. "We're closed today to make sure everyone is safe," said co-owner April World. "I still get chills. My husband won't come in here. It's weird. It's crazy." When the couple first discovered that the barricade had been knocked over, they initially believed that someone had broken in and had been prowling around the cafe. It wasn't until they checked the security footage that they realized the barricade had fallen down on its own. Oh, man. The cafe will remain closed until satisfactory explanation has been found for the phenomena. I do not blame them one bit, but I will say this. For God's sakes, man, throw some of that coffee over this way. It's been a hard week. Guys. We had a Loch Ness Monster video, a time traveler who says he's from 6491, a dead man returning to his own wake, MIT apparently, you know, testing out the old psychopathic robots, Norman Bates style. I killed her because she was a coffee pot. And of course we had a cafe that closed its doors due to, well, paranormal activity. And we all know those ghosts aren't paying for anything, too. Guys, all these stories have been odd to Newfoundland.
Thanks, John. I would like to welcome you to your MUFON Minute for July 2018. A very happy Canada Day and a happy Independence Day to our friends across the border. The website Gaia wrote a great summary about UFOs and Bigfoot and the evidence of the interdimensional connection back in May. John Keel, the prominent ufologist and paranormal researcher, famous for the Mothman prophecies, once proposed the idea that there are window areas throughout the world connecting our reality with parallel dimensions. These areas, Keel imagined, may help elucidate some unexplained reports of entities that are too fleeting or confusing to later detail or proof. With the increasing plausibility of the multiverse theory and infinite neighboring universes, maybe we should start asking ourselves, are UFOs and Bigfoot interdimensional travelers? And there could there be a connection between the two? Keel referred to these entities as ultra-terrestrials, beings capable of crossing dimensions at will, often acting as cosmic pranksters. When it comes to Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the Yeti, or whatever you want to call them, there's often a playfulness and or spookiness described in their actions. Tree knocking or eerie screams alert us to their presence, until we get close enough where they might offer a glimpse, before they vanish seemingly into thin air. Their appearance could be considered another form of a prank, embodying a primitive ape-like creature that exudes a noxious odor. Yet, they're able to evade contact with us despite thousands of reported sightings over hundreds of years. Is Sasquatch comically trolling us? An intriguing account tying UFOs and Bigfoot together comes from a 1888 meeting between cattle ranchers and a group of Native Americans in Northern California. Three crazy bears that descended from the sky in a small moon, leaving them in the woods before taking off. In another instance in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1973, a woman and her daughter were awakened in the middle of the night to a beam of light extending down from a bulbous umbrella shape in the sky. Tracking the light to where it landed in the nearby woods, the two noticed a grayish simian creature wandering towards the beam. Before they knew it, both the ape and the craft disappeared. Though these stories may be mysterious in nature, it's reported that at least 20% of Bigfoot sightings coincide with UFO events. Jack Carey, a cryptozoologist who has studied Bigfoot for decades, says he believes it's alternatively plausible that Bigfoot is being abducted by UFOs in much the same way humans are, to study its DNA and physical attributes. Carey also ascribes to the idea that something called the Mach effect could explain the possibility of interdimensional travel. This is actually a sound principle in physics. It employs the use of fluctuations created by a body of mass as it accelerates, that are in turn used to generate thrust. Carey believes the Earth's fluctuations can create momentary tears in the electromagnetic membrane separating our universe with a parallel one, allowing extra-dimensional entities access into this dimension. The illustrious Jacques Vallée is also of the mindset that there might be something extra-dimensional going on, sharing a similar sentiment to Keel when speaking about the UFO phenomenon. Vallée believes there's something more than the traditional explanation of an extraterrestrial race visiting Earth, instead believing in the possible window to another dimension. In the 1960s, the CIA investigated an alleged simultaneous encounter with Bigfoot and a UFO in the appropriately named Erie, Pennsylvania. The ensuing reports were documented as part of the infamous Project Blue Book, during which the government investigated thousands of cases involving UFOs. The area was in a peninsula arching out over Lake Erie to form Presque Isle Bay, one of the state's most visited summer tourist destinations. On the night of July 31, 1966, four tourists from New York found their car stuck in the sand after spending the day relaxing on Beach 6 of the peninsula. One member of the group was sent to call a tow truck, while the others remained in the car. Around 10 p.m., police on patrol stopped to ask if they were all right. After being informed that help was on the way, the officer said that they would check back within the hour. When the police returned about 35 minutes later, the group said it witnessed something weird going on up there, pointing to a location in the sky above the wooded area. One of the group's members went to investigate, along with the two officers. The two women in the group remained in the car while they waited for everyone's return. The investigation team walked roughly 300 yards up the beach before hearing the honking of the car's horn, hurrying back to see what happened. The women clearly were shaken. They had witnessed a dull black shape, bigger than a man, big head and shoulders, arm-like appendages, no hands, no face visible, as though it had its back turned. Right in front of their car, before it, quote, lumbered into the bushes. And then they blew the horn. A scratching sound on the hood or roof of the car was also reported. In the end, this creature was dismissed by investigators as a raccoon, despite the lady's very distinct description of a bipedal, humanoid figure. But what about the UFO? That was described as an angular craft, emitting red and orange lights, before descending down to the beach, where it radiated a beam of white light that tracked something into the woods. But eventually it took off at an incredible speed to the north, just shortly after the women encountered the humanoid figure. In the early hours the following morning, officers patrolled the area where the craft allegedly landed. The report says they noticed the presence of two unusual triangular marks in the area, coinciding with the craft's alleged landing zone. The officer reading the report said, "I have no reasonable explanation of the UFO," and described the witnesses as credible. Investigation of this case was eventually abandoned, remaining unsolved to this day. The Project Blue Book report dismisses the group's testimony as possibly a hoax, though no definitive conclusion was ever made. A local television station aired a segment some decades later, interviewing a man who said the UFO was actually a hot air balloon he ordered and built from an issue of Boys Life magazine. But this man's claim implies that the homemade hot air balloon would have traveled in a straight line, precisely due north for several miles, carried by the wind without straying off course at all. Despite the fact the witnesses' accounts describe something far more complex than a paper balloon, the man's testimony doesn't explain the strange marks on the beach where the craft supposedly landed, baffling CIA investigators. Could this incident be the result of a window area, where mysterious beings from another dimension entered our universe? To this day, the witnesses maintain their accounts of what happened, and many others have come forward saying that they, too, saw a UFO above the peninsula that evening. If you're looking for some summer reading while out in your backyard hammock, apparently the book Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook, provides a comprehensive chronological listing and brief descriptions of the events in 1973 and 1974. O'Toole's review states, "It seems pretty evident from these reports that something, whatever it was going on." Gordon does a fantastic job of just reporting what the witnesses say happened to them as he, one by one, builds the case for strange series of unusual events being paranormal or otherworldly in nature. He doesn't embellish or really give his thoughts. He just reports. This is not a thrill-minute read, but it is an important book that leaves one asking the question, what if? Remember, as you head up to your cabin and slowly transition into the summer, be sure to keep your eyes to the skies. And who knows, through the fireworks, you may see something interesting. Be sure to report it to www.mufon.com. For more information about MUFON in Newfoundland and Labrador, please be sure to check out the Newfoundland UFO Network on Facebook. Hopefully we can make it a little bit more active in the future with your help. Thanks, John!
Thank God. It's time for oddities.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Boy, that escalated quickly.
I want to believe.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
All right, guys, it's time for Oddities 10 very strange facts about our very odd world that are true. So I guess you could say they're true facts about an odd world. Number one, Donkey Kong got his name because his creator believed Donkey Kong, you know, or donkey, meant stupid in English, and wanted to convey the impression that the character was a stupid ape. Number two, the medical name for a butt crack is intergluteal cleft. So next time someone's shown some crack, you know, try a new joke besides the say no to crack joke. Try the say no to intergluteal cleft, like all of us cool weirdos. Number three, people can suffer from a psychological disorder called bonethropy that makes them believe they are a, get this, a cow. They try to live their life as a cow. That's not a psychological disorder at all. It's a great way to get milk. Number four, the name for the shape of Pringles, you know, those delicious little chips we love to crunch, is called a hyperbolic paraboloid. Jeez. Did you know there, this is number five, there's a McDonald's in every continent except Antarctica. Yeah, I mean, they looked at the profit margin of Antarctica, they realized the population was too low, and also, well, nobody's buying McFlurries up in Antarctica, trust me. Number six, Mr. Potato Head was the first toy to be advertised on TV. Very interesting stuff. Number seven, a duel between three people is actually called a truel. I think that's awesome. Number eight, the stage before frostbite is called frost nip. Makes sense because, you know, I'll probably nip you before I bite you. All I can think about is my new cat, Honey. Oh, God. Number nine, the two tiny holes drilled in every Bic pen is to ensure that the air pressure is the same both inside and outside the pen, which helps the ink flow to the tip. And if the pen was to crash to the floor, all the equipment would drop down, and this is supposed to be an airplane joke, but I totally ruined it. Yeah, I'm just going to move on to the last one. Did you know in South Korea, there is an emergency number, 113, to report spies? Jeez, King Jong, you're a little nervous, a little bit freaked out there, Kim. Wait, you got 113 is a great number to call. So, like, how do they know these aren't just people who are just really drunk or high calling this number, is my question. guys, I hope you liked your oddities. We're coming back with our mega guest to celebrate our four-year anniversary. Mr. William Jevening is coming right up. Don't you dare go away.
Attention all Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn radio listeners. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast brings you the best in East Coast esoterica on the first of every month. Together, we can keep it growing by sharing the show on social media, subscribing to the show wherever you may be listening to it from, and by leaving feedback about your favorite episodes. John certainly needs a friend like you to help make his dreams come true, minus the alien abduction dreams. That is not cool at all. The Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Always available. Always free. Always odd.
And welcome back to the Odd to Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. Is there a large, hairy hominid walking bipedal, so to speak, all across North America and in different parts of the world? We do not know. But let me tell you, I managed to find somebody out there who may have a little more insight into the notion that, well, we may have a big hairy friend in the woods with almost 40 years involved with research and documentation of the elusive creature known as Bigfoot, or as we like to call him here in North America, Sasquatch. He is the author of Notes from the Field, Tracking North America's Sasquatch, Haunted Valley, and In Search of the Unknown. He's also studied anthropology and psychology at Washington State University. Tonight, I am joined by none other than William Jevning. William, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm great, John. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thanks so much for taking the time to be on the Odd Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast. I'm going to admit, I got to say this up front, I am guilty of a carnal sin in the paranormal, is that I don't talk about Bigfoot nearly enough. So I'm glad to have you on the show. And, well, once again, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, anytime. My pleasure.
Now, the first thing I would ask William would be this. How the heck did all this start? I know it was back in 1972 that the journey for you kind of began. And that kind of blows my mind because, well, I think 67 might have been a bigger year for for Bigfoot, you know, with Patterson-Gimlin. But, you know, the first thing that pops in my head is, oh, my goodness, 1972. That's a very long time ago. Almost 40 years. Tell me a little tiny bit about what happened on that fateful day.
Actually, 45 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Making myself feel old here. I was 14, and a buddy of mine came over to spend the weekend. And there wasn't a whole lot to do because it snowed, and you know, there wasn't a lot of fun things to do out in the snow, at least to us at that time. So we decided to go walk over to another friend's house who lived about a mile away. And we couldn't find the trail through the woods because of the snow. So we decided to walk down the road and catch the railroad tracks and follow those over to my friend John's house. And we got almost there and we saw something laying between the rails. And the only thing not covered in snow was the rails. And when we approached it, it was a pile of animal intestines, and they were, you know, about coyote size, maybe medium dog. And we're thinking, well, how did this get here? Because there was no footprints in the snow of any kind whatsoever. And that kind of puzzled us. So we could see ahead of our, on our right, and the way we came, there was no tracks there. So there was a hill to our left, and I told Mark to walk on ahead and I'd climb the hill. And, as soon as I crested the hill, there were these, the snow was just chewed up with footprints. So I hollered at him. I said, come on up here and take a look. And we're standing there with our mouths hanging open because there were just dozens and dozens of footprints all over the place in the snow of these large and twice our size, what looked like human bare feet. And I'm thinking, you know, it's pretty cold. It's 17 degrees out. Who in the world would be out here? Number one, with feet that large. And secondly, barefoot. And then it kind of struck us that the animal intestines weren't frozen yet, so it was really freshly placed there. And that kind of spooked us because whatever made the footprints had to be really close by. So we took off running, and we got to John's house in just a couple of minutes. It wasn't too much farther ahead of us. And we're pounding on the door, and John had a couple of younger brothers and a couple of sisters, and here all these kids, you know, are just pandemonium in the living room. And his dad come out from the behind the house, and he says, boy, settle down, what's going on? So we told him what we found, and he grabbed a .45 pistol and a camera, and he said, take me back up there and show me what you found. So all of us went up there, and he took a bunch of pictures, and we're all kind of standing around gawking at this, dumbfounded. We never heard the word Bigfoot before and didn't know what any of this was. So he told us what little he knew. And, you know, when you're 14 and you kind of like monster movies and things, you sort of, it grabs your imagination that there's something real out in the woods like that, because we kind of lived out in the woods. And we looked for weekends, many weekends after that, and didn't see another thing. So In the fall of 1974, I actually ran into two of these things. My dog was barking right at dusk one evening in the fall, and I figured, you know, small animal, raccoon or skunk or something, and my dad always said to shoot anything coming in the yard because it was probably rabid, and he didn't want our pets or anything to get rabies, so I grabbed a .22 and a couple of bullets, and I headed out with the dog to the tree line, and he ran out there and got to the tree line, and he froze. I had that dog 13 years and never saw him freeze at anything. As I approached him, he turned around and he was staying. He was standing, staring at the tree line with his ears up and just rigid. And he turned around really fast and ran past me and all the way back to the house. And I thought, what the heck? Never saw him do that. I thought maybe he had gotten into a porcupine in his life a couple of times. So I thought maybe he learned his lesson this time and he was going to leave the porcupine alone. So at the tree line, there was bedding blackberry bushes there, and we'd cut our way through those into the tree line because, like I said, we grew up in the forests and liked to spend a lot of time out there exploring and doing stuff. So there were some low-hanging fir boughs. So I pushed my way through those into a kind of a clearing that where there was a big maple tree, and all the leaves were on the ground this time. I'm pretty sure it must have been around October because it was frosty and all the leaves were on the ground. But As I pushed through into this clearing, about 15, 20 feet in front of me is this massive creature, and it was upright like a human. It was at least 4 feet across the shoulders, close to 8 feet tall in my estimation, and it was moving the leaves around with its right foot. And I just, you can't imagine how many things can go through your mind in just milliseconds, you know, from, you know, fright to what the heck is this to, you know, oh, that must be what made the footprints we found a couple of years prior. And when it saw me, it stopped moving and just kind of stared. And I thought, Jesus, what do I do now? So I thought, well, I have my rifle. I shoot in the air. Maybe it'll scare it away. And I did that, and it just stood there. And I heard a noise from my right rear and from behind some brush. And I'm trying to keep one eye on this thing and trying to glance to my right a little bit. And I see another one walk around, and it walked over and stood next to the first one, and it was a little smaller, about a head shorter and a little lighter, and they just stood there and stared like the first one did. And I took off running and just hoping that they weren't breathing down my neck at any second. And my parents and sisters made fun of me in 72 when we found the footprints. And so we, you know, you don't talk about things and people make fun of you after that. So I called my buddy John and told him what happened, and he said, well, let's meet over there at your place around first light tomorrow morning, and we'll track them and see what we can find. So five of us met over there, and right before daylight with our hunting rifles, and we went out and tracked these things for a long time until the sun came up and finally melted the frost, and we lost the trail. So that was kind of my rude introduction into the subject.
You know, and what an interesting, well, the first thing that pops in my head is, man, what you know today compared to what you know back then. I mean, if could go back to that day now with all your knowledge and all the know-how and all the field research, what would you have done different on that day in 1972 when you came across those entrails? What would be the first thing you would have done?
I would have gone back home and gotten my own camera and taken a lot of pictures and documented and measurements and tried to trail that line of prints wherever it went. I mean, we didn't even think about doing that particular day.
When you actually looked at that creature and you seen it face to face in 1974, correct?
Yes.
Did it look at you? Did you catch a glimpse of its face? Was it mostly just its body? Did you see its eyes?
It's funny. I mean, you know, that time of day when you're losing daylight, things are kind of more black and white. There wasn't a great deal of light, but I could see pretty clearly what it was. I remember particularly its hair and that right foot. I mean, I could see those very clearly. It's funny the things that stick in your mind. The face was mostly covered in hair, very wide-set eyes, very deep, heavy brow ridge, flat nose. You couldn't see much of a mouth. It was, you know, more of a line than anything, but it was a very, very large jaw. I mean, the head, it was enormous.
You know, one thing that always pops in my head when I think about Bigfoot or Sasquatch, you know, here in Newfoundland, we have an introduced species, the moose, and it's pretty much for hunting. We have a population of just hundreds of thousands of moose, and honestly, I've been here for 34 years, and I've only seen a moose two or three times. So the idea that there might be a small population of Bigfoot out there that just escapes being captured or seen does not surprise me in the least. And because I live in a place that's, well, a forest.
And I'll tell you, I spent a lot of time in the field and have for many, many years. And when you really get out there, most people don't understand just how large, you know, I hear a lot of people, at least it used to be, you know, griping about logging and things like that and how it was going to wipe out the resource. But the areas are so huge. And until you really see that and realize what you're looking at is very small on the map. And you think, no, there's no way that's going to happen. There's just too much wild area out there. And these things can certainly, you know, skirt, I wouldn't say detection, but skirting, you know, our scrutiny for certain.
You know, one of the things I loved when I was doing my ghost hunting thing, you know, when I took it one step further and focused on the EVP was I was trying to figure out where this stuff was coming from. I came up with an idea of this grid pattern, and long story short, I finally stopped focusing on the fact that this stuff actually exists and started focusing on the how. And you actually did that with some of your work as well. You actually were able to determine, you know, just from some of the footprint sizes and how they came, where a range is occupied by these creatures. Tell me a little tiny bit about that, because I think that is absolutely fascinating. Like, that's something that's miles ahead of a lot of people out there who, you know.
From the time I was a teenager after I had that encounter with those two creatures in 74, following summer of 75 is when I met John Green and Renee DeHinden.
Renee DeHinden. That's a very familiar name to me.
DeHinden came to my home. A friend of mine, and kind of a shy guy, wrote, I didn't know he knew anything about this stuff. He overheard John and I quietly talking on the activities bus one evening, and there were only maybe half a dozen of us on that bus, and somehow he overheard us talking about what had happened. And he came over and he asked me to interview me, and I thought, well, you know, he's a nice guy, doesn't have too many friends, it's not going to go anyplace, so I said, sure, I'll tell you. And he gave me three of John Green's books. And I was floored. I didn't know there was so much information on the subject. So I spent, you know, from that time, and this was probably January, February 75, from that time forward, just, you know, fascinated, poring over these relatively small books and the pictures, getting to know who was in these pictures. And that summer I was napping and one of my sisters said, hey, wake up. There's two men here to see you. And I'm thinking, two men? I don't know any men.
Oh, no, what did I
years
do?
Old. I don't know anybody, you know. So I kind of groggily slid my barn boots on and I walked out to the back door, which our driveway came around to the back of the house. And I see a guy with a Jeep, green Jeep Wagoneer. And the other man is approaching the house. And I recognized him instantly. It was Renee DeHinden. And I thought, oh my God, here's this guy in these, you know, you think in those days, you think somebody in a book is famous. So yeah. I'm equating that to him. Here's this famous guy walking up to my house and he asked me about what I'd seen and we talked a bit and he says, well, we're camped a few miles from here. Why don't you come and spend some time in the camp, meet Green and some of the other people. So, and I think I got a little off track with that, but instead of answering your question, which I maybe better remind me what the question was on that, but Green, you know, they sort of got me to help them in collecting information, and oh, I know what it was.
We're talking about how you actually managed to use some principles of that and come up with an idea how to actually really track them a little bit easier, right? Finding where their range is to and their route, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I wasn't so much concerned with what they were. Everybody wants to know what they are, and there wasn't any answer to that. So I thought, well, I want to know how I'm either going to detect them when I'm out and about, because I love spending time out in the forest as a kid, hunting and fishing and everything. And, you know, I grew up around, you know, I confronted a bear when I was a little boy and pretty close, about 5 feet away. And, you know, I was taught at an early age to be very aware of what was in my surroundings. So I thought a lot about behavior and things like that. And I wanted to know what they were doing. I wanted to know when they were going to be around, whether they're here all the time, things like that. So talking to John Green and Renee DeHinden and Mark Pittenger and Dennis Gates and a few of these early pioneers, got me thinking about what was going on in that particular area of the South Puget Sound of Washington State. And based on what they told me and what I knew of the area itself and things were going on, it was easily for me to determine that they were coming into the area about every 6 months, and then they were going back up towards Mount Rainier. And I went in the Army after I got out of high school, and John Green had visited my parents after I was gone. I was stationed in Europe. And he said, your son probably knows more about these things than anybody alive, because what he theorized was exactly correct. They used what I told them and determined the movement patterns of that region. So I applied that later in southern Washington, in Skamania County and Clark County and Mount St. Helens, Mount Adams areas, and spent a dozen years tracking one particular group, and made a pretty good, within a 30-day time frame, of where they were going to be throughout that range and the range size.
That is absolutely unbelievable, because, you know, all we ever hear about are these chance encounters. And to hear that there's somebody out there who's actually tracking these things and can give you a 30-day window, that's amazing. And I just want to just give you kind of props right there, because I think that makes you just so much more credible than a lot of people out there who, well, let's be honest, are probably seeing a bear for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to be very critical. I always encourage skeptics. I love skeptics, because skeptics make us get better answers. And I don't mean debunkers.
No.
And people like that, because they're just absolutely against anything, period. They don't want to have a conversation.
And the paranormal, they're like trolls online.
Yeah, I mean, the true skeptics are the people who are kind of on the fence, and they're sort of like, well, either show me or disprove it. And they're willing to go either way. They're very open-minded, I think. And like I said, they make us answer or give better answers to our questions, or their questions.
So you mentioned, too, that pattern held for close on a year? Correct? Like,
yes.
That's really, really interesting. So you must have got to see some of the same kind of show, so to speak, in the woods. Tell me a little tiny bit about some of the things that you knew was a telltale sign that a Bigfoot had been there.
Well, early on, it was mostly sightings and the patterns of what was going on in areas. And early on, I mean, for many years, people would send me out on... or that I knew would call me and say, hey, there was, you know, something happened at such and such a place, and I'd go and investigate, and whatever I found, I would send to John Green or Renee DeHinden. By the mid-80s, I got kind of disheartened by that, because they weren't really doing much with the information. I mean, we went to Mount St. Helens in my senior year of high school, and we found, the first night up there, we found a really long line of tracks going up this ridge. And we took pictures, we sent them to John Green. His response was, yeah, those are pretty good tracks. That was it. There was no other information. We had an experience out by Roy Washington that we called the Clark Ranch incident, where we talked about, and this was right after I met Green and him, and we, my buddies and I, sort of formed a group we called the PCSIT. It was originally the Pierce County Sasquatch Investigation Team, and later became the Pacific Coast Sasquatch Investigation Team. One of the first organized groups to do this, and we talked about where we might have heard things, because we lived in a really wide-ranging area. It was kind of a big school district, and we were kind of far flung all over the place because it was very rural. And one of the guys said, well, this Clark family had heard some strange screams out on their property. So I said, well, see if you can get permission for us to go out there, and four of us did. We went out there, we rode his bus. That's how we got around back in those days. We'd ride somebody's bus to their house, and because our parents weren't shuttling us anywhere. So we had our packs, and we decided we were going to spend a couple days out there and look around and see what was going on. And to make a long story short, it was a night of terror. There were at least four of these things around us. They were screaming. One of the guys actually saw one. One guy was grabbed in the tent, partially pulled out. It was kind of a night of hell. I wrote Green when we got back. We bugged out first light the next day, and Green called me 2 weeks later. He was in Seattle, and he says, I'm heading to your house. Can you take me out to the Clark Ranch? And I said, sure. So a couple of my friends came along, and no sooner than we'd stepped out of his van, it was right at dusk, then the screaming started. And we all stood there for a little bit, and It was just dramatic, all the screams that were going on, and the Clark family was all, everybody was there, all these people were standing and listening to this. And then Green says, well, I have to get back to BC. So we all climbed back in the van, he dropped us off. And then years later, visiting Green at his house, we were all sitting around with Bob Titmus and a few other people, and he says, you know, to this day, I'm kicking myself for not taking a recorder.
I was just going to ask you, do you have the audio? Because I would so put that on this. Oh, my God. I got to hear that.
And, of course, none of us did. We were kids. You know, we didn't have anything like that. So I was kind of disgusted that these guys weren't following up on anything. And of course, I talked to him about it later, and he was very supportive. But I decided by the mid-80s that I had gotten out of the Army and I was going through a divorce and stuff. So I had a friend in Southern Washington and said, well, why don't you come down here and hang out for a while and get your head clear? And, you know, he said, if you like it, stay. And I loved Vancouver back then. It was a small place, only about 50,000 people. And it was just a beautiful area. And, so my girlfriend at the time talked me into kind of getting back into this. So I started, researching Southern Washington to see kind of what was going on. And Dehinden and Green told me that no one had been investigating that area since Roger Patterson did. So they were glad that there was a good Sasquatch hunter back in that area. So when I started looking at that area, we were put into an area called the Washougal River by one of the newspaper's photographers who was from the area. And it wasn't long before we started finding tracks up around the snow line. And we'd find them. I mean, the tracks, the lines were so long, we could only go as far as we'd sink up to our mid thigh in the snow, and we couldn't move anymore. But the tracks would continue. They'd start the snow line and go up. So I said, well, we found this a couple of times and we went back up. I wanted to go one more time before the snow was gone to see what else we could document in the area. And this was March of 88. And there were a bunch of us that went up to the, were heading up to this place. And I just happened to glance at the river and thinking, wow, this river is so beautiful. It's crystal clear. It's kind of a blue green color. It reminded me of fishing at Mount Rainier when I was a kid. And so I was kind of daydreaming about fishing. And I happened to glance over and I see movement. And here's this massive Sasquatch just across the river from us. And we only saw it for a couple of seconds. It was heading into the brush. And I slammed on my brakes and everybody stopped. And I told everybody in the car, I said, don't say a word. If you saw something, draw it. And everybody drew exactly the same thing. So I knew I wasn't, you know, you kind of catch yourself and you think, Jesus, did I really see that? But all of us saw it. So, that's what really got my teeth into that area. And, then of course the occult things happened in 89 and 90 and it really started establishing a pattern, through my searches in that area, and I was really able to get it honed down to I wouldn't say an exact science, but it certainly gave me a lot more information. And then by 91, I started finding things that Bob Titmus told me about. You'd asked about markings, how did I know they were in an area?
Yeah, you mentioned territorial markings, correct?
The territorial markings, yes.
Yeah, tell me a little tiny bit about those. That's actually really interesting because, you know, if I'm out in the woods and, you know, there's all kinds of Bigfoot stories about the area and I come across one of these markings, what exactly am I looking at here?
Well, let me tell you what I found. First of all, Bob Titmus, I was at his house, I don't remember what year, it was in the late 80s sometime, and he was showing me all this stuff that he found in Northern California, and he had piles of these little branches that were twisted or snapped and twisted over. And he said, whenever I was tracking Sasquatches in Northern California, I would find a lot of these. So he says, I don't know, maybe they walk along and they just do this, you know. And I didn't think a whole lot of it because they weren't real big. They're only about an inch thick. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, I grew up in the forest since I was like four. I knew what things looked like from weather breaks. So it didn't really impress me. But it's one of those things, you know, this guy knew what he was talking about and I kept it in the back of my mind. So my buddy Jack and I, we tried many times, five times, to get into this watershed on the Washougal River. And it was very difficult because of the sheer rock faces and things trying to get into the place. But we finally got in there. And I thought, well, this is where they were going all the time. I thought maybe we'll find something in there. But we didn't see anything in the watershed. So I said, well, I want to climb up this ridge to this saddle that goes over into another drainage system. And there were a lot of sightings through that corridor. So I wanted to see what was up there. And we got about 2,200 feet in elevation, and we stopped for a break. And now this is a closed canopy, big Doug fir trees. This is in the middle of July, so it was warm. There'd been no bad weather for a long time. And here's this young Doug fir tree, and it was probably 3 to 4 inches thick. I'd say closer to 3 inches thick. I measured this, eight feet off the ground. It was snapped at a 90-degree angle. Had recently been done, and it wasn't by weather, because Doug fir doesn't break that way in the weather. It has more long, sinewy breaks. And I thought, wow, that's really strange. And it was totally protected from the big trees, you know, against weather and stuff. So I thought, good Lord, you know, what did something like that? Even the little twigs weren't broken around the break. And I happened to start looking around, and about 100 yards away, there's another one. So I walked over to that one. And from that vantage point, about another 100 yards, I saw another one. We ended up finding 13 of these before I looked at my watch and said, Jesus, we want to get out of here before it's dark, so we can't continue following this line. And then a couple of Native American buddies of mine, I showed them pictures, and they said, oh, yeah, that's Sasquatches do that. That was the leader of the group showing the other ones which way it was going. I said, oh. And they said, oh, yeah, sometimes they'll mark territory with that, too. And I was really hesitant when I wrote notes in the field about putting that in there, because I knew. And this happens in the subject of Bigfoot all the time when something new comes along, because it's such an intangible topic to find evidence on. It's really painstaking that people were going to come up with all kinds of things. And today, of course, you see all sorts of structures and things, and lots of those I don't think are attributed to Sasquatches at all. But these breaks and twists, and I found both, were trees the same thickness, twisted like you'd wring a wash rag, which is really makes you, it kind of brings it to home when you think about how strong these things are to be able to do that.
I mean, it also gives you an idea like how big they really are, like how big those hands must be and powerful.
It does. It does very much.
And have you ever seen, like, the first thing that pops in my head is like a gorilla, you know, that ability, that just raw strength a gorilla has. I mean, somewhere along the line, these creatures, do you think they're related to us? Do you think they're somewhere on our family tree? I mean, you're an anthropologist yourself. You studied there. You know yourself that one of the biggest lies we ever told the world is that there's one missing link. There's actually thousands. Right. So
I suspect they're a hominid and not of the ape family.
Okay.
But that's just a guess. I mean, and it's based on, you know, classwork and things I've done in the past, but that's my guess. And I have friends that are highly qualified anthropologists who have the same gut feeling.
I think that's really interesting too. So tell me a little tiny bit more about the actual, you know, how do these things actually live? We they're so big and powerful. They're out in the woods. They got to be eating something. What do you think the average Sasquatch diet probably consists of?
Mostly deer.
Wow. So they are meat eaters.
I would suggest that they're an apex predator, and I think there's a lot of evidence to support that. There's not really enough. I mean, when you look at an animal in the wild, it needs, I mean, protein from meat gives you a lot more caloric intake than plant food does, and for a much smaller amount, it's much smaller investment than eating a lot of plant food. Gorillas can do it because it's more than abundant where they live, but something like this. And we know they've been seen taking deer many, many times. So an elk and other animals, they'll eat pretty much anything.
And I'm sure by now you've probably got a good idea. Like, they're probably traveling in a group. How many members are they usually in a group, do you think?
Typically 4 to 6, but sometimes groups will bond together temporarily.
Oh, that's really interesting because, well, we probably did that too. That's really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I would think so.
So you think there's like an alpha male, or like, do you think there's a hierarchy? Like, how do you think it works?
Yeah, there's an alpha with each group, and if the groups bond together, in other words, or not even bond together, sometimes if one group will come into contact with another one, and this happens with other primates too, you know, one group will be more dominant than the other one, and the reason that happens is that it avoids conflicts in nature, because any kind of a fight in nature can be a death sentence, you know, I mean, because of infection and things like that.
Of course, and of course, well, another thing that pops in my head, too, obviously I have random questions about Bigfoot because I'm like paranormal. I love cryptids. I love all kinds of stuff like that. We always hear people call him Skunk Ape. Now, I like to think that it might have a little something other to do with the fact that he's never taken a shower. Do you think this might have something to do with, oh, I don't know, maybe marking his territory, or what do you think?
Well, Dan and I talked about this once. I was ahead of a lot of questions because everybody always said, oh, yeah, they were equating a sighting with smell. That was a thing that everybody was asking, you know, especially media people. So I asked DeHinden one time. We used to visit each other all the time, each other's homes, and I was up at his house one time, and I said, Renee, what's the deal with smell? And he says, you know, only 1 out of 10 reports, I think that's what he said, 1 out of 10, someone reports a smell. Even my own close encounter, I didn't smell anything. So I started looking at what other primates do. Gorillas, in fact, have scent glands in their hands and sometimes on their upper torso. So they will, when they get excited, they'll excrete an odor. And I think that's what happens with these creatures too. It's when there's some sort of whatever the emotion is that gets them excited. You know, whether it's fear from a predator, us, or something else, will elicit that response. And it's not a typical response. It's just something that people sort of latched onto early on with this thing.
So there you have it, folks. Maybe we should take it a little easy with the whole skunk ape thing. It's only once every 10 times. Take a little break. You know, he had some head and shoulders. Yet he's doing great.
Yeah, it's not the prominent feature that happens with sightings.
Seems to me like you focused most of your research in North America. Nothing wrong being Canadian, eh? I'm in the other island, Newfoundland, the other side. I know you hung out in BC well, but, you know, I got to ask, because I can't help but say Yeti as well. Are these things related, or are we dealing with a completely different cryptid there?
Well, same family. And I'll tell you something, there, like here, like in Australia, there are really two main species groupings. And here, for example, is one, and I got this from a source I really can't talk too much about, but there are two main species groupings, and for a lack of better terminology, we'll just call them species group A and species group B. And each one of those groupings has two subgroupings. So in one grouping, you have like what we have in the Patterson film. And the other type, these are characterized by their size. They move mostly bipedally. They have the conical shaped head and flat teeth like we have. The other type has a mixture. It can be rounded heads, can be some of the conical. They have very pronounced canines and they'll move on all fours as much as bipedally. So, and their behavior is a lot more aggressive than the first type. So, that's something a lot of people don't understand either. And I had to think about it a lot, having a discussion with an old friend who's gone now, Bobby Short. Her and I would talk about our sightings with one another, and her description differed greatly from mine. And I used to think, well, I'm not going to get into an argument with her because I enjoyed her conversation too much. She was too good a friend. But I thought, well, it wasn't anything like what I saw. So there has to be an answer there. Either she was lying about what she saw, and I don't believe that, or there were other types. And what I found through my what I call my inside contacts is there are indeed other types, and that really fills a lot of the gaps with sightings that don't correlate with one another sometimes.
Another thing, too, it makes me think about, you know, you can't help but make the correlation with caveman and all this stuff and Homo erectus. You know, like my mind kind of goes to, what are they doing that we do? How much are, you know, Sasquatch people like us? Do they use tools? Do they build their own shelters? Like, what have you come across out there that might support those ideas?
They don't really build shelters. They may use temporarily, you know, caves for storing or caching things, but it's not a typical behavior. Now, the stone tool thing has been interesting. That's something I just started looking at, and a good friend of mine that's a very highly regarded forensic anthropologist bugged me a whole bunch about this question. He said that all primates use tools. In fact, there's a recent article about monkeys, and I can't remember where they were, if it was South America or where, but they were observed actually making stone tools. And now the thought among some of these anthropologists are that maybe early man learned how to make stone tools from monkeys. Who knows? But the fact that all primates will make and use tools I'd never seen evidence of it with these things, but talking with this other gentleman, he kind of gave me some different perspectives. And I do have a friend in Maine who did find something that actually looks like three hand axes. I mean, they're all the same shape behind his home, and this is in conjunction with a bunch of Bigfoot activity at his house. So I'm waiting to hear back from my friend about those photographs and the context of where he found them. But another thing was in 1967 in Oregon, a logger watched two adults and with what it would appear to be a very young or maybe just a toddler-aged Bigfoot. And the adults were turning over these large rocks, and they'd smell them, and then they would stack them up or pile them. And the big male instantly suddenly jumped in on this pile and dug this big hole and pulled out this nest of rodents. Well, I did a little research on that, and it come to find out rodents will congregate around piles of rocks. They'll make nests and things in them. So DeHinden put me on. He was the only one that really took this seriously back in the late 60s, because it was only the one site and the one witness that saw this. And he did a lot of research in the field himself in his time. And he and I talked about this, and he says, you know, there are other sites. And he told me the location of seven additional places like this. And I've since found others in Washington and Oregon. And I interviewed a gentleman, friend up in Canada, who was working on an oil exploration company very far up in the middle of nowhere. And he drove 3 hours to get to the helipad and then flew another 67 kilometers to the work site. So there was no possibility of a hoax up there. Nobody could get to that place. He had a sighting, some of the best footprints I've ever seen. And he found in the area these stacked and piled rocks, just like the ones I'd photographed from the sites that DeHinden and I both found. And I asked my forensic anthropologist buddy, I said, well, would something like this, could it be considered tool use? If you're making something that would draw animals in and then you'd have a quick source of food without a lot of work. And he says, absolutely, something like that could be construed as tool use because you're manipulating objects in the environment for a purpose. So that's sort of something we're looking at now, but he says that they must use some kind of tools.
Very, very interesting stuff. I love it. Let's talk about a big question, of course. We have never found a body. Do you think it's possible these things are burying their own? Is this what's
possible.
Going on?
It's also possible, sure. It's also possible they eat their own.
And that's another thing I was going to ask, too, because I know certain rodents do that as well. And the first thing that popped in my head is, you know, are there Bigfoot graves out there? Have we not come across them? Or are they doing the cannibal thing? Interesting stuff.
Either one. And even if they did bury them, now, I found one site with nine of these mounds. And my Indian friend said, no, that wasn't us. So it kind of, you know, the location, it wasn't any kind of tailings or anything like that from dredging. So something manufactured these. And I thought about it. I tried to excavate one with my archaeology background and a friend of mine who was a sociology background with me. I was so focused on pulling these rocks out and what was underneath the pile, I didn't realize he was putting the rocks back. After a while, I kept thinking, geez, I'm just not making any progress. How come? And I looked over and he's saying, oh, this might be an Indian burial and we can't disturb this. And I looked at him. I thought, what are you doing? But I did talk to other experts about things like this. And if something were buried, you know, especially in the northern parts of the North American continent, as you all know how the weather it is and small animals and everything, even large bones wouldn't last very long. So, you know, a body certainly would not last very long in that environment.
Very interesting stuff. Of course, I got to ask the tough questions, right? They got to be asked, and I'm glad you got an answer for it. Because to me, that's really, really cool. The idea that, you know, maybe there's a reason why we haven't found the body. Okay. Yeah. To top it all off, not only are you an author and a very well-known podcaster, by the way, you're also a little bit of a TV star. You were on History Channel's America's Book of Secrets, The Mystery of Bigfoot. Yeah. Tell me a little tiny bit about that experience. That must have been really interesting.
It was interesting, and the producers really had no idea from Prometheus. They contacted me, and they sort of wanted some direction. So I said, well, you know, I'd be willing to help you with this. I said, it's kind of a quagmire, this subject. So let me try to steer you right and make it a good show. And they were really glad that they did take my advice, because some of the people they were going to have were kind of disreputable. But it was interesting. I mean, it was very different than what I thought, you know, doing a television show was going to be like. And I actually had, I was contacted while I was waiting to do my segment to be filmed. I was called by, I'm trying to think of the network that put on the $10 million Bigfoot bounty. And they called me while I was waiting in the waiting room and asked me if I was interested in doing that show. They said I was their number one overwhelming choice to be on the show. And as I kind of probed that, what that show was about a little bit, it kind of turned me off, because
yes.
First of all, who are the experts judging evidence? And everybody was going to be confined in one specific area that was chosen by the producers of the show. And I thought, well, how do they know where Sasquatch is? I'm the guy that's been doing this work for more than 40 years. You know, they should ask me where to look. or at least be on the panel to judge evidence. But that wasn't what it was about. I mean, it was a reality show. So I made an excuse why I couldn't do the show. And then Sci-Fi actually had me, they flew me to Burbank to do a show that Joe Rogan was doing at the time called Joe Rogan Questions Everything. Mm-hmm. And that was a completely different experience altogether than the History. History Channel, I have to give them props, because they are really professional and really good at what they do. I really enjoyed that experience. The Sci-Fi thing, they flew me down there and it was not very well coordinated, I didn't think. We went out into the Angeles Mountains east of Los Angeles, and I didn't know there were mountains out there, but there are. And then when it came time to do my segment, Joe Rogan wanted to go down into the trees, and I was told it was going to be in a studio. So I'm wearing this sport coat, this heavy wool sport coat, and it was hot with a tie and everything. I didn't know we were going to be out in the woods, otherwise I would have dressed appropriately for that. so we hiked down this trail with the camera crew into the middle of nowhere, and he grilled me. I mean, just fired questions like, I mean, he's a good a good interviewer. And fortunately, I'm knowledgeable enough. I was able to fire his questions right back. It was like machine gun fire the questions. Good. For two solid hours.
Good. Take that, Joe Rogan.
And at the end, he says, well, you know, if I was in charge and had the money, I'd finance your work. He says, you're the only one that knows what you're doing. And then when I got back home, I got an email from Sci-Fi later. And he said, well, we weren't going to use your segment because it didn't fit in with the rest of the show. And I saw the episode, and they just used, I mean, I'm sure these were nice people, but, it, you know, and I don't mean this personally to them, but they were crackpots. It was the way it was produced was to make the whole subject look really hokey. And I thought, boy, I'm really glad they didn't use my segment, because I would have actually given some legitimacy to the subject.
There you go. You know what? I feel like I should tag Joe Rogan on this on Twitter and see what happens. Way to not have William Jeffing on your show. But you know, Joe's always on the experience around Halloween time. I mean, that's what I'd be pushing for.
Yeah, Joe's a good guy, though. I mean, he's the guy has super energy. I've never seen anybody like that. And he asks good questions. He really does.
You're lucky he didn't try to like put you in one of those Fear Factor episodes, man.
I could have put him in one with the subject. He wanted to see a Bigfoot.
You should put him in a tent.
Yeah, I told him, I said, you know, let me tell you something, man. A lot of people say that they want to see one, but it's not something you really want to experience.
And, oh, God, no. Everyone's like, I want to find a ghost so bad until they see one.
Yeah, right.
Guys, he's the author of Notes from the Field, Tracking North America's Sasquatch, Haunted Valley, and In Search of the Unknown. You can check out William at williamjevening.com. That's WILLIAMJEVNING.com. And he also has other books in the works and some that came out recently. Go ahead, William. Tell us a little tiny bit about your most recent books.
Well, you mentioned the first three. I've actually published eight. There's The Minnesota Iceman. There's Bigfoot Fieldwork 101. I saw so many what people call field guides, and I thought, well, these aren't field guides. They're nonsense. So I put something together that people could actually use if they wanted to get involved doing this. There's Witness of the Unknown, Volume 1. And Volume 2, those books are collections of people's encounters they've sent to me over time. in their own words. They're minimal editing, just spelling and things like that, but it's their own words of what they experienced. And then Bigfoot Evidence, A Case for the Existence of the Sasquatch. And that book is full of pictures. There's about 130 photographs in it. There's a picture of a couple of pictures of Sasquatches in there. One's a good broad daylight photograph taken in 2009 from Michigan. It's actually on the cover of the book, too. That's the color photo. But so there's a lot of, and it's approached from the legal standpoint. If someone were to go to court, and I didn't want to do a full trial because that's way too involved. I didn't want to get the reader bogged down. I just wanted to present the evidence, and I used that kind of pretext as the vehicle to present evidence. But if it were to go to court, how would evidence be handled? Because everybody says, well, if they exist, there's no evidence. How come? But there's a ton of evidence, and the legal system is very clear how they define what evidence is, and everything in there is classifiable by the federal rules of evidence. And if you look up that in the U.S., you know, you can read all that and see how each of these things does fit into evidence. So when people say there's no evidence, that's not true.
William, it's been a pleasure having you on the show tonight. Thanks so much for taking the time. I think we learned an awful lot about Bigfoot. Maybe some people out there are going to be a little freaked out by the fact that this thing eats meat. You know, I just had this... Well, really, I thought he ate beef jerky like he did in the commercials, but now we know it's actual meat he eats, not processed stuff.
Right.
And, you know, you've definitely opened my eyes. Thanks once again. And to all my fans who may be aspiring Bigfoot hunters, Sasquatch hunters, have you got any timely advice for them before we say goodbye tonight?
Well, if you're going to go look for these things, don't go alone. And I recommend don't go out at night.
Oh, God.
Stay out of their feeding areas.
You hear that, folks? Thanks so
you
much
don't
for being
be a sack
on.
Lunch.
Thanks. Thanks so much for being on, William.
You bet.
Well, the time to say goodbye is upon us. But don't worry, you can keep track of the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast very easily. It's available on Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, and TuneIn Radio. Just look for the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast banner. Of course, if you'd like to keep up to date, you can always check out the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast Facebook page, drop a like, and every single time a new show goes up, you'll be notified. You can also follow me, John Mallard, on Twitter, at ODDTONFLD. That's Odd to Newfoundland. From the oldest city in North America, I bid you adieu from the Odd the Newfoundland Paranormal Podcast.